Welcome to the Mo Money, Mo Progress podcast. We bring you interviews with amazing people who share advice about how to make more money and manage what you got.
Hello, welcome back to the Mo Money, Mo Progress podcast. My name is Gwen. Thank you so much for listening in today. We have an incredible guest on our show. Gloria Roheim McCray is our interviewee today, where we have a very honest conversation about what it took for her to become a full-time entrepreneur. Gloria is the co-founder of Wedge 15, where she's a brand and momentum strategist, and she's also the Amazon best-selling author of BYOB, The Unapologetic Guide to Being Your Own Boss. So everyone listening right now who is an aspiring entrepreneur, you gotta read that book, ladies. And gents, y'all gotta read it. I read it. Actually, I'm in it. Oh my God. Actually, I have tons of copies of that book. So I highly recommend it. So in this conversation, Gloria is incredibly honest about her early 20s and how she bought into some ideas like buying a condo or getting married that, you know, didn't really pan out the way that she thought it would. And she shares very openly and honestly about how she figured it all out. And she also shares about how many jobs she had before she was 25, before she figured out that entrepreneurship was her calling. It's a fascinating conversation, and I can't wait to share it with you. So I'll stop talking, and here it is, my conversation with Gloria Roheim McCray.
Gloria, thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
My absolute pleasure. Thanks for inviting me, Gwen.
Anytime. You know I love you. So I want to start by how we always start, with some rapid fire questions to get to know you and to get to know maybe your quirkier side, and then we'll get straight into the heart and the meat of the interview. So my first question to you is, what is your greatest extravagance?
My quirky personality. My greatest extravagance. That's good. I love that. So I interpreted the word extravagance as like, for whatever, for better or for worse, something luscious, something sort of luxury, something a little out of the ordinary, above the top. So I really gave thought to like what area of my life isn't extravagant. I think I'm quite an extravagant character. So I think my greatest extravagance is living myself, living as myself, and being unapologetic about that.
Now that's an answer. I love that. What's the first thing that comes to mind when you hear the word money?
Prosperity, possibility, love. You know what? Self-love more and more. Mm-hmm. It's really just a thing. It is a total stand-in for value that we all perceive in the world. And so because I value myself, I value my life, I value the people in it, I do have a love for money because it allows so much more opportunity for all of us when we have it.
Yes, we love money. All the money. Bring more money.
Dollar bill, yo.
What is your favorite financial tool or app that you might use?
Love that. So if it comes to accounting for our business, FreshBooks, if it comes to managing and looking at the bigger picture of my money and my credit cards and my bills and all of that, mint.com is where it's at. Get my alerts from Mint as well. So it's like, hey, you got a bill coming up. I don't got to think about it. I make it fun and easy. And those are the main tools that I use for anything sort of cash flow, money.
What is something that you patiently saved up for to buy?
So, goodness. Savings was a huge part of my right out of school mindset. And that was 15 years ago now, my right out of undergrad into my MA. And I had saved up to buy a condo.
And we're going to get into that condo story.
We will, because I don't own that condo no more.
Yes. What is your favorite financial book or resource?
Tony Robbins has blown my mind, and I think he'll blow yours too, with his recent book, Money. In fact, I can't remember the subtitle, so that kind of sucks. Hopefully, we'll be able to include that in some stage. But it was a Christmas gift this past Christmas from my mother-in-law. I had bought the audiobook shortly after hearing about it last fall 2014. And then when I got the physical book, I literally just sat down and I disappeared into understanding the world of the financial markets. He makes it so palpable. He translates it for the layperson, which is what I'm interested in, because I really haven't found it too exciting to talk about the hardcore money investment thinking, even though I love money and I want to grow it and do great things with it.
I am so thrilled that you said that. I mean, I've seen that book. It looks intimidatingly large.
Yes, it does. It's a big fat book. And this is why I bought the audiobook, right? Yeah. And I was listening to it for a little bit. And then I thought, you know what? I want to see he's painting such a vivid picture in the book that when you see it in print, it also really helps. So it's something that you can go back and forth to. You don't have to read it in one shot. This is not school. You don't got to finish the textbook. You know, it's going back, I think, to the different chapters and just immersing yourself maybe one chapter a week into it. And then, you know, letting it kind of trickle in, because it's a re-education and things that we have never learned in school. We are unlikely to have learned from just being alive. And we probably have misinterpreted for large part based on the sort of money myths that circulate our world. So I love it because it just gets straight to the crux of it. He talks to the richest men in the world who give him their inside scoop on what, you know, how they make money and how they grow their money beyond just having a salary or earning at a job.
I am sold. I'm buying the book.
Buy it, Gwen.
Done. Awesome. And if you were gifted $10,000 today, no strings attached, what would you do with it?
Well, thanks to the new insight in the money book, I think I need an affiliate link to make some sales off of this. But anyways, maybe that's a second.
I know.
I really have shifted what I would do with a big lump sum of money over the years. Honestly, today I would split it. And by the way, the money book is Money Master the Game, 7 Simple Steps to Financial Freedom, because my amazing husband just showed up and showed me the book. So I could tell you that. And that's Ricardo. But back to what I would do with it. I would divide it up and do different things with it. My old philosophy, the way I was raised around money, was if you get a big lump sum, put in a savings account or pay off a debt, you know, in big chunks. And so I was really used to doing that. But I've learned over the last 15 years of my money growth and my sort of understanding, having made some interesting calls with my money, that it's best to kind of, for me, based on my lifestyle, to divide it where I would take, let's say, $2,500 to pay down toward a debt and, you know, $2,500 to put into an investment, $2,500 to put into just a savings. And then $2,500 might be to indulge and to enjoy. So really using money as a tool to enjoy and enhance my full 360 life, not just to be pay down my debt girl or a save up for a rainy day. Really, you know, over the long run, if you did that all the time, every area of your life would expand. And so that's the kind of money mindset I'm in these days and really what I would do with $10,000.
Dude, that sounds, sorry, I keep saying dude, but oh my God.
Dude!
Dude, I'm California. That I'm not. That sounds beautiful though, you know, to actually use it to experience life and not just pay down something, invest. It's like, let's do something fun with that money.
You know what? I think it's key because again, it's a tool. You know, I've definitely had times in my career and even in my early business where I lived to pay the bills. I know that everybody's experiencing that, especially if you're coming out of university or college or any kind of schooling in the first phase of your career. You're probably just thinking, I just want to make any kind of money possible. And it's just exciting. In fact, I didn't even think I negotiated my salaries early in my career because I thought whatever money you want to give me, whether that's $30,000 or $10,000, I'm in. Give it to me. It's more than I've been making, you know, for whatever long. And so I did interesting things with it. And it's only through learning from spending all the money and then trying to save all the money and then investing all the money and realizing that once you get that lump sum and it disappears, you're right back to square one. And that feeling left me thinking I was doing the right thing, but feeling like, well, that money just immediately disappeared as soon as it came in, whether it went into something positive like paying off your debt or saving or, you know, it got spent on something. And so I started to think about how else could I use and have a relationship with money that it felt prosperous, because that was my intention. I want to feel prosperous and rich, not just with zeros at the end of the account, but even if it's a $20 purchase or a $20 investment, whatever that is, it should always feel exciting and forward moving for me. So I started to relook at my money habits to that vein, and it's really, truly, absolutely changed the way that I relate to earning money and all of it. So I love money now. We're friends.
Oh man, make money your best friend. Well, actually, that's what I want to start getting into is there will be a lot of people listening to this who admire and love your perspective towards money, but they are not best friends with money.
Mm-hmm.
It's an enemy. And so I'd love to go back, you know, as you mentioned 15 years ago when you first got out of school. Can you tell us about your experience of getting your first job out of school? What was that whole process like?
Oh my gosh, absolutely. So there's one caveat to my university experience, my post-high school experience, and that is I was not eligible for student loans. And although my father had invested large sums of money into my education, in the 1999 stock market crash, he lost all of what he had invested, which was my brother and my full tuition for the whole undergrad. So about a year before I went to university, I thought I was going to be supported, and I found out I wasn't. So that, to be honest, wasn't too scary at the time because as a young person, I just thought I could do anything. I mean, I kind of learned my limitations a little bit more and more over time, but I thought, okay, well, cool. I didn't know better. I thought I could work full-time and go to university. So I did. No one really told me I couldn't, although everyone thought it was undoable. They thought, well, you know, you can't do both. So I actually worked at Royal Bank Financial Group in a department that was open 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. And I went to work after my classes. So I would go, you know, 5:30 to 10:30 were my shifts every single day. And so interestingly enough, I realize how kind of abnormal that is now, but it didn't seem so at the time. And so my relationship to money was always very functional. It was, I'm going to school, I'm going to pay for school, I don't need much more outside of that. And when I get out of school, then I'll make some, you know, really big money and it'll all work out. So that was my mental state around money when I was graduating. And the lucky thing for me, which was kind of crazy, was I got out of university completely debt-free. I didn't have a student loan. I think I had a $500 limit Royal Bank student visa that they gave me, which I thought was just insane volume. Like, I thought that was so much money. I remember being scared when I would use $200 of it. I wanted to pay it off immediately. That was sort of the original mind state of my young adulthood around money was pay off everything soon, save, and don't spend. And I get that's probably a very common student mentality. But coming out with that mentality, I also had work experience. So when I got my undergrad in political science, I moved back from Montreal, from McGill, where I was, to Toronto. And within a week, through relationships, through calling people and letting them know I had graduated, and I had done some volunteering with the Liberal Association at McGill, I said, hey, I want to work for the Liberal government in Ontario, and I want to do policy, and I've got my poli-sci degree. And it turned out that my boyfriend at the time, his cousin worked for one of the MPPs, the minister, the members of parliament. So I got right in. My first job was a $30,000 salary as a legislative assistant to the Minister of Finance in Ontario. And I was mind blown. Do you know that I thought I was the bomb diggity? I was like, 30 grand? Excuse me. I think I made that much in like 3 years of work. I must have made that because that's what my university costs. So I made it over a longer period of time. But to make it all in 1 year, I remember feeling so just excited and I thought I had made it.
Sorry to interrupt you. I'm just curious. Yeah, do you remember if you negotiated for that salary or if they said, hey, we'll pay you 30K and you're like, that's amazing.
Okay. Love that question because I didn't even know you could negotiate. I really didn't feel comfortable. And I really thought, as many people out of school do, and I think this is an okay mentality, especially for your first job. I think it should change thereafter. But when you're, you know, just trying to get the first or second opportunity for yourself so you can gain experience, so you can be in the work environment and so you can apply what you've learned, I think it's totally fine not to negotiate. And I thought that was true. I just thought, whatever you want to give me, I'll do as long as I have a job here. Because, you know, the scarcity mentality that we all come out of school with is, especially now, oh my God, you're lucky if you get a job.
Yeah.
So I didn't negotiate that. And I really had no idea what any of my peers were making. I didn't even think to ask. I only found out later and then realized how differently I was salaried from them. And I did that particular job for 6 months before I got a conversation with my boss at the time, who gave me an automatic raise by $15,000. So it went up to $45,000. And what's so cool about this for me at the time is I'm getting the impression, my first experience is you don't have to negotiate your salary. You don't have to ask for what you're worth. You don't have to ask for a raise because it'll just come, because that's how it went for me. So that was my first experience thinking, this is how, you know, money gets done. This is how salaries happen. And this is how you get your raises. And I learned very soon thereafter that that was a very unique situation. And no, in fact, I'd have to negotiate for the rest of my life, which I actually have learned to love, to just really negotiate the value that I bring and to really learn how to present that value so that I can earn, you know, what I perceive is what I'm worth in that particular position. So that was my early stage of money and jobs out of school.
Yeah. Well, now that we're on the topic of negotiation, I know there's so many recent graduates. I'm friends with a lot of, you know, students that are going to be graduating soon. And they come up to me and they're like, Gwen, how do I figure out how much money I should be making? You know, how do I negotiate? And I mean, for me, negotiating has been research and just trying to understand it. What advice would you give to Little Glow when she was first starting out, you know, about trying to understand what is your, you know, quote unquote worth? And how do you ask for what you want?
Oh, I love it. I think how would I put this to her? I'd say, Little Glow. All the things you think people see about you and know about your value and your qualities, don't assume they can see that or that they know it. They're coming from their world and they're thinking and approaching your salary and your compensation from their best interest. And that doesn't mean that they don't care about you. It just means that you're the one who has to advocate for what you're worth and make a really compelling case based on your experience, based on what the goals of that job are and how you're able to fulfill that and bring, you know, serious value to the table. And by the way, that doesn't mean, oh, I've got 10 years experience doing this, so hire me. I think I really misunderstood early on that credentials, my university degrees, you know, and my job experience were the most important things. And that was what I tried to use to negotiate. But don't forget about those things, little glow, that you bring to the table that are more intangible, like your social intelligence, your emotional intelligence, your ability to really bring a positive, uplifting energy to your team. Because when you work in office spaces, or you work in, especially in this case in politics, there's a huge value to being the kind of person that is just a joy to be around. You know, I mean, Gwen, when I think of you, I don't have a single memory or experience where you weren't literally joyous. And even if you were having a hard time, the way you handled that and the way you related to other people was so gracious and so loving and so just honest and vulnerable that it invited me to want to be with, like, around you, spend more time with you, collaborate with you. And those are real things that bring value to an office space. So it's beyond your credentials, beyond those things. Look at the 360 of who you are. And if you're having trouble figuring that out, I mean, it's best to ask your closest sort of peers, people you've either collaborated with, people who are in your, you know, who worked with you on projects, or even sometimes your family members. I mean, that's always questionable depending on your relationship. But I mean, really, the people around you will help you understand when you're in the room, what do you bring to the table? You know, when you're collaborating, are you somebody who's exceptional at delegating? Are you somebody who's exceptional at really empowering people to get things done? Or are you just the awesome person who, no matter what happens, you get it done? And what kind of examples can you show to really have people get that? Oh yeah, look at the track record once or twice or three times, and look at every part of your life. Don't just look at school. Don't just look at your career. Look at, have you been on sports teams? Have you been in athletics? You know, there's so many facets to our life that I think we forget. And when you really look at that and you allow yourself to notice how great you are, and, you know, and also areas where you can continue to develop yourself, you can make a much better case for what you're bringing to the table and why you believe it should be worth X number. So I did do a little research always on, you know, I finally clued into, like, is everybody else making the same as me in the equivalent position, or am I making something different? And it actually turned out that it was unheard of that I got a raise for $15,000 in my first 6 months. That was unheard of. And that's, I was amazing. At that point, I know it was amazing. And I could tell you what I believe caused that. And so I realized I was being paid more than everybody else. But I also started to feel like, after, you know, you make that kind of money and you realize after taxes, you barely take anything home, that wasn't actually enough, yes, you know, for me to cover my basic cost of living. But again, I didn't really worry about money at the beginning because I was really lucky to have also, I was in my master's at the same time and I had a full scholarship there. So I had another $20,000 in scholarship money and the tuition was only $5,000. So I had another $15,000 on top of that. So we're at like $65,000. I'm 22 years old and I've got leeway now to start saving money, which eventually led to me purchasing a condo in which I ended up losing all my money. But I mean, that's the early stage of negotiating and understanding value, your worth. And it's really, it's all about experimenting. Like, you just don't know. There's no one way to find that out. And sometimes you got to really be curious, poke around, you know, and try different things. But little glow at 22, I would have told her, just experiment. And I learned that value later in my 20s. It paid off big time because you just might as well ask and try. When people say no or not right now, it just literally means that. It's not a, you know, it's not a no to your character. It's not a no to your self-esteem. It's not a no to you as a person. It just means, based on what's going on right now and the way you position that to me, no. That's it.
Exactly. This idea of, I think it's a Jack Canfield idea of rejection, where you didn't have it before, you know, you don't have it after. Nothing really changed and you get to choose how you deal with that rejection. But glow, you bring up such a great point I've never honestly thought of. It's that, especially with women, there's a lot of intangible kind of, mm-hmm, skills that we have, and it's hard. And, you know, when you're in a negotiating situation, they want the facts, like, how did you go from 0 to 100? How did you figure that out? And I know with recent graduates, or when you're just starting out, even taking those examples from sports teams or mm-hmm, random examples of in the office of how you know, change the atmosphere of it is huge. That's so valuable for people. And I've got to say, we got to hear this condo story. We've been alluding to it. Let's just get to it. What is this condo story you speak of?
What is this condo story I speak of? So I don't know if anyone else has this perception, but I somehow got the idea along the way that to be a really successful, responsible person, you have to invest in a property. You have to own where you live. And, you know, after renting for years, you constantly hear, you know, renting is like throwing your money in the garbage. And I don't know. I believed it. I don't believe that anymore. I have a very different perspective, but that was only something I could gain through experience. And so I was like hellbent on buying a property as soon as possible, because if it takes you 30 years to pay off your property or your mortgage, whatever you buy, then start early and then you'll get a head start and you'll be winning. And so that was my head around Yeah. All of that. And so at the time I had a partner who was also working. And so together we qualified for a mortgage. And I remember, what was it? It was something along the lines of, it was, I think, $260,000 for a condo, probably a one bedroom condo in up midtown. I guess you could say it's uptown, North York, Toronto. You know, I thought this was like luxury living. It's right above the subway station. And so you didn't even have to go outside. This was like the big catch for me. I was like, this is worth everything in the winter that I hate.
Oh, yeah. You could go
downstairs and go underground to the subway station and get on the Yonge line and go right downtown to work. So we had looked for that. And so together we were able to put a down payment on this property, saved, put in the money. And I thought, brilliant. Not only have we made it, but you know, we've got a condo and we're going to grow our money. But I didn't do the math on like how much interest payments were and how much money every month when I paid that mortgage payment with my money, which I think was probably $300 a week. We were paying weekly because there's, you know, the banks tell you it's, you pay it down, you pay less interest and you pay it down faster when you do the weekly payments. All of this is very confusing, to be frank. And there's a reason that it's confusing. And there's a reason I love Anthony Robbins' book, because it breaks down this confusing thing, and it's meant to be. So you're not stupid if you don't get this. You're not missing something. It's intentionally confusing because it benefits the financial institutions. But to make all that sort of come to the point of the condo story, I ended up putting all my money into it. And about 3 months into it, I started getting an icky feeling in my stomach, like everything I make is just being poured into this one thing, and everything I've saved is being poured into this one thing. And by the time this one thing pays off, it's going to be about like another 15 to 20 years by the time we start to make money on it, in the sense that, you know, the property value has gone up and everything else. So I started to kind of question this choice. And the way that life went, my then partner and I ended up splitting up. And of course, all for the best and all healthy and amicably. But that meant that the money was gone. Okay. And so he kept the condo. I lost not only the money that I put into it, but an additional $15,000. Because when you get a home, you get something called a line of credit. And the banks will give you more credit when you own something. So you start thinking, and they tell you that, you know, this is for like buying furniture and improving your home. And I thought, well, of course, that makes sense. So you start spending this money that is so free at such a low interest rate at like 3%. And eventually you end up with more debt and a mortgage. And you're basically living in this, I lived in this feeling of spinning on a wheel and literally bringing home the money and putting it right into that one thing. And that feeling just sucked. I wasn't able to save at that point. And I started to feel like I was actually losing, not winning. To make a long story short, I ended up getting out of that. And I started fresh at 24, 25 with debt, you know, and this was a really ego killing thing for me because I came out of university debt free. And I thought I had made it. I did this, you know, I did quite well initially and ended up leaving that situation with no property, with debt, which I never had before, and sort of wondering, what am I missing about money and what am I missing about earning? And so that was a sort of fork in the road for me. And from that point on, that's when I really started to change direction and think about starting my own business and shifting lifestyle, which is a whole other chapter for a whole other podcast, but really hugely valuable lessons. And that's, you know, why I mentioned $10,000 would be spent in a very different way now, is because I learned from those examples and that experience that it's really critical to look at what you want to do with your money and not just follow what you hear or what you believe about what you hear around you. And to really be really dig deep and introspective about what your money means to you and how you want to use it in the world.
Yes. Amen.
Yeah.
I have to just mention this because I feel like you are the example of, well, you are a branding expert as well, which makes perfect sense. But you're willing to share how navigating your way through the new economy, having multiple jobs before you turn 25. I don't want to spoil the sentence, but can you share with people how many different jobs that you had over the years and how and why that you kind of went that way?
Totally. Okay. So I mentioned earlier that I was working through my undergrad, but I had started working at 15. By the time I had turned 26, I had had over 21 different jobs. And so the one I talked to you about right after my undergrad lasted up to a year. And from that point on, I still went on to about 5 different positions. And before that, before even the Royal Bank that helped me pay my undergrad, there were so many different stints and different contracts and summer positions abroad and things like that. So I had experimented the life out of my career because I was in this hungry search to find out, is there a job or a position or a place that I feel fulfilled in? I was looking for it all outside of myself, where I could go that would be the ideal job. You know, people are always trying to find this thing that they love. And it's so frustrating because I heard a lot, and I don't know about the rest of you, Gwen, you can pipe in for sure, that you're supposed to know what you want to do by the time you're done.
Oh God, yeah.
And like, you got to know, and you know, oh, this generation of millennials, you know, you guys just don't know what you want. You can't. And I thought that really sucks. And it's very disempowering. And for me, having 21 different jobs, and to be frank, a lot of those were really great jobs. Like I say, working as a policy advisor for the Minister of Finance, working as a market research consultant, as the very last corporate gig that I had for 2 years with the Strategic Council, and you know, some retail things, Lululemon in there. I worked at 5 different departments in Toronto and in Montreal for the Royal Bank. So even though it was one company, there were 5 different gigs in there. Worked in Hungary in Eastern Europe, which is where I'm from, for a summer for 6 months or 4 months, excuse me, during my undergrad, year three, I think, on another policy project, on a social development project. Worked on a, you know, 1 month project with students in Montenegro for the government of Canada too. I had a dream. I had a vision that I would find my ideal job in international affairs somehow. But the more I would do these different jobs, I'd notice around the 6 month mark that I kind of checking out. I like it, but I can tell that I'm not using my full potential, and I'm feeling frustrated because I'm feeling like, and I was actually told this a few times, you've got to put in your time, which everyone hears, at one place and show stability and be there. And so I was once told, you know, you would get a raise or you'd move up in the company if you made it here past 8 years. And at, you know, in your early 20s, that sounds like a lifetime.
Yeah,
you know?
It totally does.
I'm like, 8 years, you know, and everyone, actually I won't say everyone, but the large proportion of people around me were really concerned about my constant job changing. But I kept saying to them, my perception was, but I've never been unemployed. And they'd kept saying, yeah, but you got to stay at a company longer than a certain amount of time, or it's going to, you know, your luck's going to run out. I said, this isn't just luck. Like, there's actually, I'm presenting my value, people are buying the value, and I'm getting opportunities, and I'm not leaving them in despair. I think when you're looking for jobs, you're dating the company as much as they're dating you. You get put on probation for 3 months, and I put them on probation for 3 months.
I like you guys?
Yeah. Are we going to have a good time here? Are we going to do it? Are we going to have a good synergy? Are we going to do the best kind of work we can do together? And it takes some time, takes a couple months, even sometimes a year, to sort out, is that the right fit? And when I knew that it wasn't in each of those cases, it was scary. I'm not going to lie to you, but I felt I had to go and look for the next thing. And so by the time 2010 rolled around, I came to the conclusion that after I had some, you know, I've experimented a number of times, different countries, different cities, different career fields, that, you know what, I think what I'm missing is that I'm supposed to be my own boss. And how could I do that? I mean, I never thought about starting a business. I always had the dream that when I finished school, I would have a career in the government. But the more I worked in that sector, the more I realized there's so much more entrepreneurial spirit that I bring to the table. I want to create projects. I want to create change. I'm willing to work and hustle like nobody's business. Why don't I try just doing that for myself, since I don't seem to get permission in the companies I'm working for to really do that to the fullest? And I should say that every place I've worked and every manager and boss I've had has been exceptional. So this is not, there's nothing wrong with any of those positions or places or people. But what I realized was what I was looking for outside of myself was actually something I needed to look inward about. And so that's when I decided to resign from my last position. And that was 5 years ago, and start my own company, which today has led to so many incredible things, including merging my business with my now husband, a best-selling book, lots of different media appearances, incredible projects in Toronto and abroad. And what we do is brand strategy. So I got to take what I was learning along the way, which is positioning and repositioning myself, and actually turn that skill into a business that I help other people with. And so it's kind of funny how the path goes, but I think if you can courageously allow yourself to be unsure along the way and just keep moving your feet and keep trying, the path makes sense at some point.
You are such the example of, you just kept trying, you kept getting experiences, and it led to, oh, I'm supposed to create it myself. I'm supposed to be an entrepreneur. We have a few minutes left, and I'd love for you to share with people who are in the same boat that you were in many years ago, when you're in a job and you're like, okay, I know I'm supposed to start my own business, be your own boss, if you will, but they just don't know how to do that. Like, should you quit your job outright? Would you, you know, start doing things on the side? What would your advice be to people who are in that position right now, knowing they've got this thing they want to express, but they don't know how to do it?
100%. I love that. And I think that I used to think, of course, we always like to think that what we did is the best thing. So there was a time where I thought, you should do what I did. You should just quit, make it really hard on yourself, give yourself the pressure, and make it work. I don't really know that that's not a good thing to do. I mean, it's totally totally doable.
Terrible for it. Well, I have a terrible experience with it. So
I totally agree with you. And I wouldn't give that advice anymore, but that's hindsight 2020. Mm-hmm. What I would say is there's three places after now having worked with, I mean, we work with businesses and entrepreneurs a lot more in advanced stages of their business now, but watching them and even having my own experience, I now see that there's three ways you could do this. And none of those, either of them, any of them are great places to start. You just got to start to develop your own internal compass and sort out for yourself, you know, what kind of risks are you willing to take? How uncomfortable do you want to make yourself before your mental health starts to suffer? And yeah. Realistically, because it can be very stressful. Everything about figuring out what direction you want your life to take is a very big deal. But the key is to no matter which one you choose.
Several languages. How many languages can you speak?
Oh, that's hilarious. What a segue. You're such a media professional. I speak four. I'm Hungarian by ethnic origin. So Hungarian, English, French, and Italian. And my husband's Trinidadian. Oh, so he now tells me I speak Trini.
They're the best. They're the most amazing power couple in Toronto, everyone. I don't know where you're listening to this from, but they are the Toronto power couple in my eyes.
You're amazing, bud. Thank you for all your support. So basically, you can either, I think, you got to take care of yourself first. So whatever your basic cost of living is, whatever bills you need to pay, whatever, you know, payments on student loans, whatever those responsibilities that are yours are, you need to make sure you can get those handled first. So that can look like, I mean, depending on what the number that is for you, you can either survive with a part-time job getting that done while you're building your business, or, you know, you could take a leap and jump into it. But I think you've got to really look at how you can reduce your cost of living if you want to make a leap like that, because at the beginning, you are going to be experimenting. You don't know how it's going to go. And most people's businesses don't pick up in any significant way when it comes to earning until about after the first year. So it's very, very sporadic. And sometimes it could take up to 3 years, 4 years. So you're really making a long-term marathon commitment. I think when you choose to be your own boss, you're marrying yourself and you're marrying this business like a partner for the rest of your life, or for as long as you can handle it until it's unhealthy. And you've got to sort out different ways you can get creative with making money. And if you're doing a business that's brand new, like let's say you're starting a jewelry e-commerce site and you've never done jewelry before and you don't already have clients or customers who are interested in buying, it's going to take longer than if you've been working in a company doing that very thing and you've got a relationship base who you can say, hey, I'm going to start my own thing. Would you like to come over and support my, you know, what I've got, and here's what I've got, and here are the prices, and here's the site. So I think the best way to do it is actually slow and steady over a period of time where you still have your cash flow and your cost of living handled by a part-time thing or a full-time thing, and you're slowly transitioning yourself over. Then there comes that point when you have to choose, and this is the hardest one. What point is it? Are you ready to leap and go full time into this gig? Or maybe you just want to keep it as an extra source of income, whatever that business is, whether you're selling social media management services, helping people maintain their accounts, whether you're making jewelry and you're selling them online. You really do want to get clear on your own vision. So I can't actually answer, nor can anyone, frankly, which path is best for you. But you do need to consider those key things, like how can you reduce your cost of living? What do you actually need to take care of yourself first? Because I can tell you, when you don't take care of yourself first and you don't cover your own, you know, financial responsibilities, whatever you're building can never get the best of you because your mind state is not clear. And I went through that myself. And that's why I can say, you know, I really thought I could overcome that. And I did end up doing so, but at an unnecessary cost of pain and suffering, which I don't suggest you need to go through. So I think the key is whether you're starting a business or whether you're going to have a job at a company, if you take the boss mentality and you think about yourself like an entrepreneur, whether you have your own product or whether you're working for a company, get your mind into the boss mindset where you're fully responsible, where you've got to negotiate for your best interests, where you've got to show up. And there's lots of ways to do this. It doesn't require you to be an extrovert. If you're a more quiet introverted person, please look at Tara Gentile's quiet power strategy. There's space in this economy for all of us, but it does really take all of us choosing to take ownership over our careers, our money, and our life by thinking like our own bosses. We are the boss of our life, and I'm super passionate about this. That's why I wrote a book about it. And I think it's the best place to start, especially when you're starting out.
I super appreciate you being so transparent, even about, like, you know, you can't really be your full creative self if you don't have a financial foundation. It's extremely stressful, speaking also from personal experience. So, Glo, we have officially just about run out of time with you today. So my final question to you is, if you could give listeners one piece of advice about money at any stage in the game, just what would your final words of advice be?
It's man-made. It's a game. And all it is a representation and something we use, literally a currency, to exchange money for what we value. And it's not as heavy and as significant as we all have grown up to believe it is, depending where we've come from. So if we can relate to it more like a game and have fun with it and honor it and celebrate it when we have it and be grateful for what we had when we don't, I think that the whole world of money becomes a lot more peaceful, enjoyable, and fun.
That is a truth bomb if I've ever heard one. And I do realize I do have one more question, and that is, where can we find you? Where are you? What are you up to? How can people buy your things and now give you money?
Let's do a value exchange, shall we?
Yeah.
I love that. So my company website is wedge15.com, W-E-D-G-E-15-1-5.com. And when you go there under our work, you'll see a link to my book. And I think that's probably the best place to start if you're interested. The book is called BYOB, The Unapologetic Guide to Being Your Own Boss. It's also available on Amazon.com, but you'll find every link you need through the website at wedge15.com. And if you want to say hello, I'm also on Twitter at Gloria Roheim, G-L-O-R-I-A-R-O-H-E-I-M.
Wonderful. Gloria, thank you so much for your time today. We'll make sure we link up everything so people can click on your link and buy your book and learn more about you, because we literally scratched the surface. So it's just been so great to be here talking to you today.
Thanks for having me. And oh my God, subscribe to this podcast because it will change your life.
Yeah, thank you. It's awesome. All right, bye, Glow.
Bye, Gwen.
Thank you for listening. To find more interviews and tips to help you make Mo money, go to momoneymoprogress.com.